Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Liende? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Hoi luisteraar, wij zijn Hugo, Max en Leon van de Grote Podcastlas. Wij zijn drie geografen en elke week behandelen wij een ander land.
We spreken onder andere de geschiedenis, politiek, natuur, maar ook de sport, de muziek en natuurlijk het eten.
De nijlpaarden van Pablo Escobar, de vele bunkers van Albanië en het verschil tussen een sheik en een emir zijn zomaar wat voorbeelden die langskomen.
Maar we bespreken ook de geopolitieke invloed van China in Afrika en de impact van het Europese kolonialisme.
Luister dus wekelijks naar de audioversie van de Atlas, de grote podcastlas.
What globalization and new technologies have done is that they have radically increased the returns to being smart. And we are a social species that gets smart by being around other smart people. And this urban edge has not gone down, it has gone up.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hello, welcome to Betrouwbare Bronnen, a Dutch podcast, but this episode is in English. In episode 82, the guest of PG Kroeger and me is economist Edward Glaser, the Fred and Eleanor Glimp professor at Harvard University, author of the book Triumph of the City, and specialized in the economy of cities. Special thanks go to Tilburg University Society and Professor Sylvester Eifinger, who facilitated this conversation when Edward Glaser visited Tilburg University in January for the Vrienden van Kopenhagen Lecture 2020.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome to Betrouwbare Bronnen, Professor Ed Glaser. Why must we love cities?
Humankind is a social species. Our greatest talent is our ability to work collectively. On our own, we are puny creatures not able to stand up to the lightest of bears. Collectively, we do miraculous things. Cities are machines for enabling us to collaborate. Machines that enable us to buy and sell, to trade, to meet one another, to learn from one another. And so, in a very deep sense, we are an urban species. We become more human fundamentally when we are surrounded by other humans, and that's what cities do that is important.
Nowadays, 53% of the world's population is urban, and that will increase to 68% by 2050. And that's a good thing, you mean?
I know of no pathway out of poverty into prosperity that does not run through city streets. When you compare those countries in the world that are more than 50% urbanized to the countries that are less than 50% urbanized, the more urbanized countries have on average incomes that are 5 times higher and infant mortality levels that are less than 1/3. I know of no future in rural poverty, but that doesn't mean that there are not tremendous downsides that also come with density. There are, what we as economists call negative externalities associated with crowding people together. I call them sometimes the demons of density, which include contagious disease, traffic congestion, crime, high housing costs. And when you see these costs, particularly in the developing world, particularly in the great growing cities of the poorer countries, it is very tempting to just say, wouldn't it be just better if poor people stopped coming to these cities? But that is not the right answer. The right answer is to fight to make these cities more livable, more humane, to make them greater places of opportunity. And to take on that vocation is one of the great challenges of the 21st century. And for anyone who's young who's listening to this, right, there is an amazing life that can be had in fighting to improve the cities of the developing world.
Yeah, but there are not only problems in the developing world, but also in our cities here in Europe. You mentioned young people. They are not able to have an apartment anymore.
For sure. The downsides of density exist everywhere. Some of the problems that come with density, the wealthy world has largely been able to eradicate. So, for example, we don't typically worry about clean water most of the time, except in American cities like Flint, in which they've let delayed maintenance get so terrible that you can't drink the water anymore.
Clean water is one of the miracles of the modern economy, because clean water has been forever one of the great, luxuries, you could almost say. In the Middle Ages, it was water led to disease, etc. And that is in the modern societies over. It's an incredible,
absolutely
incredible achievement.
You know, in Shakespeare's London or in New York 120 years ago, a boy born in the city could expect to live 6 or 7 years less than a boy living in the countryside. The most important element in that was the water quality. Right, and there is no more important job for city government than clean water. And you know, America's cities and towns were spending as much on clean water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government, the national government, was spending on everything except for the post office and the army. This was an incredibly important thing. And I promise you, I'm not dodging the expensive housing thing, but water is just too interesting and important to avoid it. One of the things that's really important that you learn from water is that it's not just about infrastructure. New York builds the Croton Aqueduct, right, 1840-42, and the city is still having cholera epidemics for another 25 years. And the reason for that is that you built the aqueduct, but poor people didn't pay for the connections. Poor people weren't willing to pay for this. Exactly the same problem we're having with the last mile problem in Africa. It's only when you have the Metropolitan Board of Health after 1866 that starts charging apartment building owners, tenement owners, for not connecting, that starts imposing fines on not connecting, that you start really eradicating the cholera problem. You really start getting the public health
better. So you need also
incentives. You need governance as well as infrastructure. Yeah. And the same thing is true in traffic congestion and in high housing costs. So you're absolutely right. You know, someone growing up a generation or two generations ago in the U.S. Or in Europe could expect to be able to afford a pretty decent apartment, or in the U.S. case, a nice suburban home in a decent neighborhood. That's really all changed. And I think one of the many reasons why so many younger Americans, and I think Europeans as well, look at the system and think that it's rigged against them is that the housing is no longer there, that this is not an affordable product. And the irony is, housing could be like cars. Housing could be like computers. You could make housing fairly easily, but you can't make it if we're going to put rules in place that make it very, very difficult to deliver large amounts of housing on a small amount of land. Right? In the case of a city, the natural way to deliver lots of apartments is to build up. Right? This is exactly New York, you know, remained affordable in the 1920s despite a huge amount of demand for urban space, because during some years the city permitted 100,000 new homes every year, 100,000 new apartments every year, right? Since the 1970s, new permitting has slowed to a trickle in the most attractive parts of the U.S., many European cities as well. You know, consequently, the supply of new apartments is much more restricted, and when robust demand collides against restricted supply, prices go through the roof, and that's exactly what we've seen.
In the Netherlands, we need 75,000 new houses every year. They are not there, and still there's an expectation that in 2030... there will still be a housing shortage of 200,000 houses. So that's a big problem also in the Netherlands.
It is a big problem in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands problem is in some cases more difficult than the U.S. problem. And I'm going to get myself in a little bit of trouble with those Americans who may listen in. But the truth of the matter is that your cities are more precious and beautiful. And so messing with them is a more risky business, right? So no one really thinks that the old city of Amsterdam should be marred with large amounts of apartment buildings on the old canals. That would be a crazy thing.
There were some ideas about it in the 1960s to do it.
That's not at all what I'm recommending. But, you know, there's still a lot of space.
The 1960s plans of Amsterdam, if you look at the drawings now, it looked like Los Angeles, really.
And it is not my business to tell Amsterdam where it should allow height, or to tell the Netherlands where it should allow height, but there's got to be some space where you can find some old public housing projects from the 1960s that you can tear down and triple the size. There's got to be some areas in which you can actually accommodate more density to be put up.
Yeah.
And that's the only way to make this happen, is to allow more construction.
And the main solution, you say, is have lesser regulations in the housing business?
The prices for housing now are such that the private market will supply it if it's relatively easy for it to do so, if there are not regulations that make it impossible. Same thing is true in London. Same thing is true in most of the expensive cities in the world. You can't provide really cheap housing with private supply, right? If you really want to take care of poor people, you need some form of a public subsidy to do that. But, you know, medium price, middle income housing, the private market can deliver it, and can deliver it nimbly and well, but it needs to have space to build. It needs to have areas in which it's relatively efficient to add new density, whether or not that's, you know, on the urban fringe or by tearing down something that's old and not loved. You've got to be able to do that. And there's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. The only way to make sure that there's real affordability is to create enough units.
Yeah. I come from the city of Amsterdam. There are many, many rules. And there are also many problems the city council sees, like Airbnb. They need more apartments for youngsters, for nurses, for police officers. They want to help them, but don't really know how to. And now they are introducing a new rule. You have to go to live in your newly bought house and not have others to rent it. Is that a good idea?
So anything that restricts mobility, restricts choice in housing, comes with costs, right? If we're allocating a unit to you but someone else values it more than you do, you know, the basic logic of economics says you should be able to rent it out to that person. Now, there are presumably good reasons why Amsterdam has the public housing policies that it has, and that a large share of the city is actually in various public housing units. But I think we do need to be cautious about policies that make it easier to allocate space to the people who really value it most. So Airbnb, for example, is a classic example where you've got a little bit of extra space and you're trying to get a little bit of money out of it. Banning Airbnb, of course, comes with costs. It comes with costs to the people who have a house and maybe want to earn a little bit of extra cash. Some Airbnb units, plenty of Airbnb units, are, though, done by professional operators. And it's easy to look at that and to say, well, wouldn't we rather have this space being allocated to long-term residents rather than to short-term tourists? That's a totally understandable feeling, but it's a very, you know, less than optimal response. The right thing is to allow people to do Airbnb, but to build enough housing so that you don't have this huge fight over a small amount of space. So I have a student who is just finishing up her PhD this year, Sophie Calder-Wang, who was estimating the impact of Airbnb on New York City's rental prices. And it's not that Airbnb has no impact, but it's on the order of magnitude of about $100 a year maximum to the households. Right?
That's
so it's
nothing.
It's not a huge dollar. So it's important. This is a symbolic thing. It's not a thing that actually makes any difference.
Are there special Airbnb regulations in the city of New York?
There are some. They're often quite flouted. They're often quite, and there are, of course, interesting policy experiments where some cities will ban Airbnb and a neighbor will not, which enables you to look at these things. One of the things that's interesting about Airbnb is it pushes up prices for rich New Yorkers more than for poor New Yorkers. And the reason for that is the people who rent out the Airbnb units are doing it in nice parts of New York, not in terrible parts of New York. So I assume the same thing would be true within Amsterdam. I mean, the other thing that Airbnb raises, the other flashpoint, which is true in many European cities, is dealing with large tourist populations. Amsterdam is one of the world's greatest cities with an absolute priceless architectural and artistic legacy. Dealing with tourists can be difficult. There are, I think the most natural way, if an economist thinks that there are downsides to having too many tourists, is to tax the things that tourists buy and, you know, earn a little bit more money off of it. So, you know, if you tell me you've got too many tourists, I say you're not charging them enough. So
Well, that's what the Council of Amsterdam already sees. And they're trying to get rid of all those youngsters from the UK that come in on Friday and go back on Sunday.
Stag and hen nights.
Right.
And don't use a good hotel.
Yeah, so that might require the appropriate liquor tax of some form. I don't know. I mean,
maybe Brexit will help.
The other issue that came up when I was in Barcelona thinking about these issues is the issue of you know, the tourists who are not very good neighbors, right? So the tourists who actually will cause, you know, quality of life deterioration in the city. I think it's not a terrible thing for cities to think about mild law and order interventions on this, right? I mean, many of these tourists wouldn't behave this way in their hometowns because if they did, they'd be, you know, locked up in jail. Something bad would happen to them. I don't think you want to be in the business of locking up British tourists permanently. But, you know, if they're causing a lot of trouble at 2 a.m., you can lock them up until 6 a.m., right? You can do something with them that limits their ability to cause trouble just in a very short run without in a community center or something like that. So I think it is important, you know, cities, because you're cramming in so many people together, they need rules. And they actually need rules to be enforced. And one of the rules that needs to be enforced is you're not allowed to walk down a residential neighborhood drunks and screaming at 3 o'clock on a Thursday night.
Yeah. And in your papers, I read that you set the city of Houston as an example in building houses because they don't have many rules.
Much of Texas historically has had very few rules, Houston being a particularly extreme example. The reason why Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, and Phoenix, each of them as metropolitan areas, added 1 million people between 2000 and 2010, that growth is, you know, would be impossible without a very, very liberal attitude towards new construction. And mostly that starts with very, very light touch zoning and just an ability to mass produce housing. I mean, that's part of the other difference is that what happens is when you have these highly, you know, defined zoning rules, every new house needs to be custom made. Every new house needs to be fit in, needs to have an architect who goes through things. So it's basically the difference between mass production and, you know, having your suit made by a tailor, and one is a hell of a lot cheaper than the other. And so the Texans managed to mass produce housing. Now, all apartment buildings are somewhere in between, but it, in some sense, should shock all of us that building apartments has not gotten a lot cheaper over time. Most of the time, technological change works to bring down production costs. The only reason I think that it isn't in construction is because we've erected so many rules that makes it difficult to figure out how to appropriately mass produce attractive, you know, livable units.
Yeah. In the Netherlands, we have a fiscal arrangement called mortgage interest reduction. In Dutch, we call it hypotheekrente aftrek. Is that a good idea?
This is one example of the kind of demand subsidies, at least as I understand it, that governments, when they're faced with high housing prices, because they're not willing to take on the politics of allowing more construction, they say, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll give you some form of a demand subsidy. We'll give you some sort of a, you know, it's a housing voucher, or a reduction in mortgage interest.
A sort of rebate.
Some sort of a rebate. Yeah. But the problem is, right, if you've got a fixed supply, Economics 101 tells you that just pushes up the baseline price. So if you give everyone a 10% discount, then they'll just bid to, you know, 110% of the original price. It's really a very less than desirable outcome relative to fixing the root of the problem, which is you just aren't building enough homes given the level of demand to live in this fantastic country.
I know you like to walk to cities, through neighborhoods. Can you mention us a place where we all should go and watch what's happening there?
Oh, there is, well. So I'll give you some places that I think are fabulous. So I love
preferably places nobody goes to.
Oh no,
and nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Well, I will tell you one of my favorite comparisons, and I believe this has changed slightly, is between Nanjing Road in Shanghai and the Pudong District. Now, these are not places that nobody goes. Of course, there are millions of people who go to these places.
So it's not Shanghai.
But we're hoping that maybe not all of your viewers have been there last week. Not all of your listeners. But Pudong is Chinese. So larger point that I'm trying to make here. Let me just make it. Cities fall into two traps, one of which is opposition to new construction, not in my backyardism, NIMBYism, opposition to new development. The other trap is monumentalism. Is building for the sake of building. Most extreme in imperial cities, right? Think Astana, for example, right? So you're building vast structures that nobody particularly needs. But democracies can do this too. Democracies can build large projects that aren't really worth doing.
And the nouveau riche want to have the most extreme building for themselves.
Indeed. So the Chinese are their cities do occasionally fall into this monumentalist trap. India is more likely to fall into NIMBYism. So Pudong is this new area where most of the skyscrapers that are most famous in Shanghai are. They're built to vast heights.
they were traditionally built with lots of green space around them, and so they didn't work as pedestrian spaces. You would go there, and it would feel like, you know, if you were outside, you were in a howling wasteland, right? And then there would be these large disconnected towers, felt if there were nowhere. Whereas you cross the river, you end up on Nanjing Road, and you're in just a marvelous urban space. There are people who are exercising there. People who are sitting playing games on the street corner, buying, selling, walking around, enjoying the city, enjoying each other. Just sort of a marvelous space showing sort of all of China's energy and industry at its best. And it's because it's a slightly older area and it's built on, even though they're large buildings, it's built on a fundamentally human scale. And sort of trying to understand the ways in which the physical structures relate to the way that the people use that structure. There's a wonderful book by Holly White, W-H-Y-T-E, who also wrote The Organization Man, called The City, which culminated many years of Holly looking at the way that New Yorkers used public spaces and how, in fact, many of these spaces actually ended up being wildly underutilized. Some of them had particular protective features that enabled them to be used. But this is something that I sort of urge all of your listeners to do, is anytime you have a chance to see humanity in motion in cities, see how the physical space shapes how they interact. Nanjing and Pudong provides one example. But, you know, the differences of moving around monumental...
So it's not only... talking about Shanghai, the Chinese government is the king in urban planning because they only decide it themselves. They don't have to work with businesses and other regulation problems. They can decide it themselves. So it's easier to build in China than in Europe or in America.
Absolutely. And it's often a tabula rasa, right? You're often starting from a place of very low levels of urbanization.
You can decide today to build a city and within 2 years it's there.
Absolutely. And you know, when Chinese engineering is good, it's very, very good. But it's also true that they build cities in places that no one should be building cities and they end up producing ghost towns. So, you know, both of these things go on. It's whereas India is... so I'll give you another place that's worthwhile walking around, the Dharavi slum of Mumbai. And, you know, at least my experience when I walk around Dharavi is it's a poor place, but it's not, you know, wildly poor by standards of developing world ghettos. It's actually a place that's unbelievably full of industry. You walk down and you see a couple of guys and they're, you know, recycling boxes. And that means you chop open the boxes and you turn them around so no one can see the old labels. And a little bit further on there are two guys inside of a workshop and they're sewing undergarments. And you think you're in the, you know, some old, you know, Soho factory in 1906. And then a little bit further on, there's a ceramics cluster and they make pots and they're so proud of the pots, they won't even charge you any money for them. And you just feel thrilled with like the energy of Indian entrepreneurship. And then you walk outside and you see a child defecating in an unpaved road. And you know the water isn't fit to drink and the electricity is malfunctional. And it reminds you of how much cities need not just, you know, individual energy, but also some form of public sector maintenance, some form of public sector care to actually deal with these downsides of density. And in some sense, the sort of Indian slum example is one in which you see the sort of extreme of like public failure and private success. And I think that motif helps us understand a variety of the current discontents about urbanization, both in the poor world and in the rich world. I mean, in some sense, the housing issue that you've raised captures the fact that demand for cities surged after the 1980s, and the public sector has really never totally adjusted.
So you have to deregulate to be able to build enough houses, but you also have to regulate in some way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For the public infrastructure, for water, for transport, so that the roads aren't clogged, etc.
You heard me wanting to regulate the drunken tourists more. I mean, I'm happy to. There are lots of areas. There's no such thing as a sensible libertarian in a city. Cities need rules.
What is the best governed city in the world?
Well, it's hard to beat Singapore. Singapore is extraordinarily good at all of the urban functions. Now, I certainly prefer a little bit more chaos in my cities than Singapore. But if you ask yourself where would you go if you wanted to figure out how to do crime better or public housing better, right? Singapore has a public housing system that works unbelievably well. I think in some sense you can learn the wrong lessons because, you know, certainly in America we wouldn't be able to do it nearly as well as they can. Their mass transit system works incredibly well. Their schooling is superb. all of these areas, Singapore does just unbelievably well. And
but I'm always told Singapore is run like a business. Every minister earns more than $1 million a year. There's also censorship. And there's also corporal punishment.
And there's authoritarian government.
I am, as I said, I like a little more chaos in my yeah. city than Singapore tolerates.
To be very honest, a city which is probably not very well governed. But let's put it that way. For a historian like me, the not so very well governed cities tend to be the most fascinating. Think of Mexico City, think of Cairo. You already said Mumbai. They're probably not very well governed, but they tend to be fascinating.
Absolutely. And just to one last quote, right? There is, I am always on the side of the fight for freedom. But if we ask about who can actually deliver city services, that's a different, it's a different question. I just want to differentiate that. Mm-hmm. But your point about chaos being much more interesting is also true. That's also right. So I grew up in New York in the 1970s, right? When the city was an absolute mess. Right, in lots of ways, right? Crime had expanded enormously. The city was on the verge of bankruptcy. But boy, was it interesting. And we've had 30 years of, by and large, great success. And much of the city is less interesting now than it was in the chaotic 1970s. Now, I'm not saying that New York should wish to go back to the 1970s, but it was a very interesting time.
But you'll probably also be a great fan of Robert Caro's book on Bob Moses.
So I think Caro's book is a tremendous piece of scholarship. I also think it's incredibly slanted. So I think that Moses, you know, when I was a kid growing up in New York, every park that I played in, every pool that I swam in, every road that I drove on was given to us by Robert Moses. And it is important to remember when you read those things. And Moses did some really bad stuff, particularly later on in his career, right? Moses,
but he was a genius.
He managed to get infrastructure built. And we could use a little more of that in the U.S., even though ideally we're going to have a little more of it where we pay more attention to the needs of poorer urbanites and we make sure we don't eradicate neighborhoods in the way that Moses was willing to do. We do need balance.
It is a bit the way that, like, the people in Chicago remember Mayor Daley. Also, maybe not a very great liberal, warm personality, but a guy who delivered.
Cities need some of that. I mean, I hope, and just to be, I just want to re-stress this again, that I am not in any sense, I'm completely on board on the view that we never want to go back to a world of the 50s and the 60s in which builders run roughshod over local complaints. That is absolutely not what I would ever advocate. But at the same time, we need to have a world in which not every person has veto rights over every new building or over every new project. And we need to have a way in which we actually enable infrastructure and buildings to be delivered in a timely and efficient fashion rather than go through a 15-year planning process for everything.
Yeah. Thanks to the internet, we can work everywhere, but you still say, go to the city.
Well, to be clear, I'm an economist, not a lifestyle consultant, right? So I am not actually telling anyone they should go to the city. I am remarking on how amazing it is in the internet age that cities remain as vibrant and as exciting as they are. And just to be clear, there are lots of people who, you know, want to live in the mountains and want to live in the woods or want to live in a smaller town. And, you know, by all means, and great cities are archipelagos of neighborhoods that give people different options, high-rise neighborhoods, low-rise neighborhoods, older buildings, newer buildings. You know, variety is a thing that every decent economist loves, giving people more choices. Now, that being said, there still is this amazing thing that when I got started in this business 30 years ago, observers of urban growth, of urban change, noticed that the decline of the cost of transporting goods, rise of highways, rise of containerization, lowering rail costs, had radically reshaped urban America and had basically caused an enormous amount of deindustrialization throughout the entire urban world. Right, because you no longer, every one of the older, colder cities in the U.S. was built on a major waterway. All of their industries were anchored by ports or rail lines. And when those transportation advantages became irrelevant, the industry moved to places where labor was cheaper, first in the suburbs, then in the Sun Belt, and then across the oceans to lower cost countries. And when I started in this business 30 years ago, some smart observers of urban life said, oh, Well, if lower transportation costs for goods killed off urban manufacturing, then lower transportation costs for ideas are going to kill off urban financial services and urban publishing and all these other urban businesses, which rely on people communicating with each other. And I thought they were wrong then. I wrote my first paper on this in 1994, and I think they're wrong now. And I think the right way to understand this is that what globalization and new technologies have done is that they have radically increased the returns to being smart. And we are a social species that gets smart by being around other smart people. And this urban edge has not gone down. It has gone up.
That is for you the fundamental analysis why, after the, you know, the downsizing of cities, certainly also here in the Netherlands, cities as Amsterdam, cities like Rotterdam, lost population, and not a few, but, you know, 10, 15, 20%. And then they suddenly became hot again. Even Rotterdam became hot again, and, you know, they are now attracting young people from the Netherlands, young people from all the
and
world.
Parts of those cities who
and
were,
this has to do with this analysis.
Parts of those cities who were rotten in 30 or 40 years ago, they're now the hotspots.
Absolutely.
And this has to do with, this is your analysis of it.
It's the main thing. Yes, it's the main thing. There also is a sense in which a more educated and a more sophisticated population has increasingly been willing to pay for urban entertainments. This is the rise of the consumer city. And that is also going on in Amsterdam and Rotterdam. Not in every city, but these are also places where people want to live as well as people who people want to work. One way of thinking about this is as the world becomes more complicated, as technology becomes more complicated, as ideas become more complicated, it is harder to communicate them, right? The more complicated an idea is, the easier it is for that idea to get lost in translation. And we have evolved over millions of years for having these cues for communicating comprehension or confusion that are lost when we're not in the same room with one another, right? This is why face-to-face contact is still highly relevant, right? This is why, in fact, if you're going to have a really important conversation, you really don't want to do it over email, right? You really want to actually be there so you can gauge the emotional response of the person. The experience that I have giving a lecture and doing a video feed is totally different. I mean, you know what's working with your audience when you give a lecture. You can bring them into it in different ways. And that two-way face-to-face contact is just incredibly valuable. And that's something that in an idea-intensive world has helped bring cities back.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
One of the problems caused by the internet is, for example, in my city, the amount of bookshops 20, 30 years ago was, I think, 5 or 6 times as high as it is nowadays, because we can buy books through the internet. So shopping streets sometimes have closed doors, closed windows.
Or all the same chains everywhere.
There were, for example, some nice small streets with nice small shops, then are being replaced by all the chains we know already.
So this is true. I think the vacancies, so you certainly see the large-scale retail vacancies in some parts of Manhattan. I think that's likely to be a short-term phenomenon, right? Largely because that space will be reutilized. Someone will figure out that space is proximate to a lot of people. It may not be the same thing. It's likely to focus more on selling experiences rather than selling goods. So, for example, I was just looking at Yelp transition data. So I've got Yelp data from 2012 to 2018, and so we look at Yelp stores that close and Yelp stores that open. And the dominant thing that you see
For our listeners, Yelp is an app, a site, where you can ask questions like, what's a good restaurant?
That's right.
Where can I go for some things? And
that's right. That's right. It's very common in the U.S. And what you can see is, because you view the same addresses and you see stores that close, is that a lot of goods-selling stores close and are replaced by restaurants or cafes or bars, right? So you have this sort of replacement of goods with experiences. And I think that's likely to be the case. You know, there are bookstores that combine the book experience with, cafes, with bars, with things like that. So you still get books in there. I mean, the old reader in me always feels sad when a bookstore closes. So I totally get that pain. But I think the odds are that at least you're going to get reutilization in a creative way of that space. Now, that being said, and this is sort of a hard thing for someone who basically is afraid of too much public planning to get, it's almost assuredly true that the private market doesn't get it exactly right. So just think about the way that the people who own shopping malls run them. So if you owned a large American suburban shopping mall, right, a terrifying prospect for me, but if you owned a large shopping mall, you wouldn't, just offer your space
seen
up.
From Europe, those all those extremely large shopping malls are still a strange thing to experience.
As a tourist in America, you go there, as a European, as if you go in Europe to an ancient castle or cathedral, just to walk around and say, we don't have this.
You should actually. This is exactly, if you want to understand urban spaces, this is also an urban space to go to. Go to an American suburban shopping mall, which in some sense is an attempt to create urbanity in a suburban car-related structure. It's in a car-related world. But the owners of these shopping malls don't just offer the spaces up to the highest bidder. They offer discounts for shops that are interesting, that will bring people in. They offer higher prices to other things. They creatively manage this space in order to find – now, it may not be to the taste of your readers, but to your listeners, but it does bring in customers. And so the same sense is if you were an urban owner of a three-block area, you would not just say, let's make it all banks. Right, because no one would come. You try to figure out some way to create an interesting mix of retail that combined maybe the most lucrative shops with the ones that were interesting and drew people in. And I certainly think there are lots of cases of large-scale retail operations of people actually own multiple shop areas or multiple blocks where, in fact, this kind of creative structuring is done in real urban spaces as well as in shopping malls.
May I ask a more cultural question? Everywhere in the world, and especially also in Europe, in the Netherlands, there's a gap between the rural areas and the cities, a cultural gap.
Which is increasing. They seem too polarized.
They seem not to understand each other anymore. How shall we cope with this problem?
Yeah, you certainly felt something like that fallout in the recent American election. I actually blame the urbanites, like myself, at least as much as
in America. You see, the Trump voters are in the rural areas, and in the cities are the Democrats.
I think that so. I would actually say that this is an area in which I think cities are failing more than rural areas, because there is just no attempt to understand the values and the mind view of people who are living in lower density areas that don't have the same sort of onrush of change, that are living in a more traditional lifestyle, that are often, in the case of the U.S., I mean, there's a whole swath of territory, which I've called America's Eastern Heartland, which starts down in Louisiana and Mississippi, runs through the mountains of Appalachia, and ends up in the Rust Belt cities of the old industrial
Some
areas.
People call this flyover country.
So in the U.S., the reason I would differentiate between the Eastern and the Western Heartland is that American joblessness is concentrated in the Eastern Heartland, not in the Western Heartland. So the sort of natural resource-rich states of the Dakotas and Wyoming and Colorado, these are places in which employment rates are very high, education is traditionally very high in these places. These are not the parts of America in which you have sort of very, very high levels of male joblessness, high levels of opioid consumption, very low levels of education. That's sort of an Eastern Heartland thing as opposed to a Western Heartland thing. And a lot of this is about education, right? In some sense, in terms of overall economic growth, to be a very reductionist theorist, and that I think the two things really matter, one of which is human capital, investment people, and the second of which is decent government rules, a decent set that enable entrepreneurship but also keep people safe from harm and do the right combination
of things. And strengthen the formation of human capital through education, through R&D, through communication, through the arts, etc.
Absolutely. The Western Heartland has actually traditionally been the birthplace of the American high school movement, which started in Iowa. Agricultural wealth got turned into human capital over decades. And traditionally, they've been pretty well run. The Eastern Heartland, however, had both the Jim Crow's cotton country in the South, where mm-hmm. education was deeply low partially because of racial reasons, but also for other cultural reasons. And then the industrial cities, the kids were earning too much working in the factories to take them out and get them go to school. So they also had less investment in high schools. So that's the area of America that's most problematic. And it's the area that is most crucial for successful urbanites to try to understand. Because unless you are able to find some common bond with these people, they're going to vote for someone other than you. And if you're going to nominate candidates who are only going to speak to people who share your values, you're going to ensure an America that's split. And I think the same thing is true everywhere. That we have all of us.
It's like President Obama who said, there is no red America, there's no blue America, there's only the United States of America.
His speech at the 2004 Democratic nomination, Democratic convention, absolutely. It's a great set of lines, and it's a very important set of lines.
But hard to do.
But very hard to do. But it starts with at least with some humility that you know we are those of us who love cities and live in them are lucky to be there. But there's nothing about us that is intrinsically better than people who live in rural areas.
When we look at young Americans, 50% of them would prefer living in a socialist country nowadays.
This relates to your question on housing. I think when we look at the experience of younger Americans, I think many of them feel that the status quo has failed them. They look at the very long, painful decade of recovery from the Great Recession. They look at the Iraq War. They look at housing, which is out of reach. They fear climate change and see a government that's doing very, very little about it.
Huge debt for education, your university.
Huge debt for education. And a government which has been often referred to as a pension plan with an army. Right, which is not their priorities. Right,
pension plan with an army.
It's not my line. The American government spends large money on programs for older Americans, and it spends money on its military arsenal. Those are the two things that it does. Neither of which would seem to most 22-year-olds to be their top priorities. And so they think the current system is broken. The one thing that socialism has going for it is because it's been anathema in the U.S. since 1919, but certainly since 1945, it can bear no blame. Whatever you're seeing going on, it's not socialism's fault, right? So that's the one thing that socialism really has going for it.
Which makes it, of course, completely different from Europe.
Absolutely.
In Europe, young people, they can be liberal, they can be left-wing, but none of them wants the German Democratic Republic to come back.
Right. And, when you ask them what they think socialism means, there was a Gallup poll on this. Oh, very few of them say it means government ownership of the means of production. That's which is its actual definition, right? They think it's about being more social. It's about being nicer. It's some other.
It's not about building the Berlin Wall.
But the current system is broken. It does need fixing. But it needs fixing in a way that empowers individual creativity, not that creates government bureaucracies. One way that I've come to think increasingly about this is that I read Manker Olson's Rise and Fall of Nations, Rise and Decline of Nations 30 years ago when I was in graduate school. And it didn't impress me that much then. There's lots of Manker's logic of collective action I thought that was brilliant. But his sort of view that in stable democracies, you have these groups of insiders that basically come and take over the chains of power and they block outsiders. It didn't feel like America to me. And, all of his rhetoric about the Heath government and ungovernable Britain. Well, Margaret Thatcher seems to have come along and blown up a bunch of that. So it didn't seem like it was that right. I tell you, 30 years on, I think he had America exactly right. I think we've had 30 years I see this most of all in housing, where the ultimate roots of these regulations is not random top-down bureaucracy in the U.S. It's local community groups who are dead set against having any new construction, right? Many of them rich, many of them opposed to the smallest amount of public housing, and they've managed to get the system to work for them. It's, retail store owners who have put on regulations against opening new businesses in the area. It's occupational licensing. It's the lobbying group that represent senior citizens that are unwilling to consider the slightest increase in the retirement age.
Yeah, you mentioned Margaret Thatcher. It's a bit like the trade unions in the UK in the 1970s, 1980s.
Absolutely. So it was the trade unions that completely stopped Heath's attempts at reform in the early 1970s, who made England seem ungovernable. But it's important that Olson's vision, and I think the correct vision, is not particularly about left wing versus right wing. His vision was that there were the unions, but there were also trade groups that represented rich people that were and the same thing would be true in America today, right? There are some groups that, for example, public sector unions that have blocked change in education and have stacked compensation really strongly towards pension plans away from current dollars. But there also are Wall Street bankers who have worked the system in various ways. It's true of both groups, but it feels very much like we don't have a capitalism for outsiders. And that is what really America needs. It's not socialism, but it needs a capitalism that actually gives people who come into the system more and then does less to get in their way as they work.
Yeah, and I think some youngsters see all the main politicians being paid by big business, by Wall Street, also Hillary Clinton in the past. And they turn to Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren.
Absolutely, and they're right to be revulsed by that. That's exactly how insiders wield power, as they you know manage to figure out ways to compensate politicians for doing their bidding. That's exactly what Olson was talking about, and they're right to be revulsed. You know, there's a lot to like about the independence of someone who doesn't take that, that money. That's certainly true. But they do have to have policies that actually make sense at the end of the day. It's not, independence is not enough. You actually need to have a system that actually has a good track record. And I think over the last 250 years, there are lots of things to like about capitalism. It doesn't necessarily solve every social inequity. It doesn't necessarily make sure that every 10-year-old gets a decent education. It doesn't necessarily make sure that everyone has an even chance going into the system or is insured against something going wrong. You need capitalism and you need to make sure that capitalism hasn't stacked the deck against outsiders. But it's certainly a much better place to start with a system that actually empowers us as individuals to make changes rather than says that the power lies with the government bureaucracy.
Yeah. It sounds a bit like, let's say, Ludwig Erhard, you know, soziale Marktwirtschaft, social market economy, so with the social conscience.
I think they're both good things to like about markets and good things about consciences. I like them both.
So not building a Berlin Wall, but building houses.
One of the things which we raised about this sort of cultural gap between urban centers, metropolitan centers, and rural centers, of course, has to do with, and that is a new phenomenon which we discussed earlier, is that the cities, and this is a trend, a new trend of the last 30 years, suddenly became hot again, became vibrant, became young, attracted a lot of cultural and human capital, and those rural areas are shrinking in population. And you also see in the US that people then think, well, if this part of the country is shrinking, we will lose also political clout. And that also, so the demographic element is something, well, maybe of the last 30 years, 40 years, we haven't got, you know, got used to yet. That this is the new trend maybe for the next 100, 150 years.
It certainly is something that creates traumas as rural areas shrink. One of the things that's really striking when you look at the migration data is just how much better educated the people who left rural areas are than the people who stayed. And that means that through this process of migration, many of these communities are left a little rudderless. And which makes the challenges they face even more severe. Over time, I've moved. I mean, I think probably 25 years ago, I had a very sort of cold view that we should just help poor people, not poor places, and we shouldn't worry about poor places that are declining. I never was a complete purist on that, but I've moved a little bit on this. It's not that I believe that we need extra subsidies for declining places or for poorer places. I don't think you should bribe people to live in places that are not succeeding economically. But you often do need policies that are better tailored for local realities. So, for example, you don't really need an employment subsidy in Seattle, Washington. Pretty much everybody's working who would possibly want to work. But if you were going to have a larger employment subsidy program like America's Earned Income Tax Credit, it seems to be more sensible to put it in West Virginia, which is an area with high levels of joblessness. Or if you want to be a little bit colder about that, think about the design of a disability program. So a disability program has two aspects, one of which is the base payment on disability, and the second of which is how much do you let people keep their earnings after a certain level. The work of Magnus Malmsted looking at an experiment with Norwegian disability payments show that if you let people keep more of their money, they work a lot harder. In an area in which you have sort of a large joblessness problem, again like West Virginia or Appalachia, it makes more sense to let them keep more of the dollars that they work by, that they earn by working, to give them more of an encouragement to work. And so you might want to lower the base payment slightly, but enable them to keep more extra dollars to raise the threshold of what they can earn. So I think you want to not necessarily subsidize poor regions, but you do want to make sure that you're not imposing a one-size-fits-all policy that says that just because this looks like the right thing for Amsterdam, we're going to impose it on a rural area.
But you also, what I find striking, I was very recently in Houston and in Texas, both in the cities and in the really rural part, the panhandle, etc. And what I found striking, that for instance, a city like Houston, in the last, 10 years, developed a almost European sort of public transport system with almost free buses, etc. And in Texas, you know, the country of the oil industry, etc. And those cities, those sort of magnet cities, yeah, which are growing strong, also become much more, let's say, sophisticated in their public infrastructure. And if you compare that with other some smaller, even shrinking cities, for instance, I was also in Amarillo, and there you see they don't have that. Is this development of cities that they become more, you could almost say, sophisticated, is that part of this process in which the rural areas, you know, shrink? Because the cities become also in that sense more attractive.
Well, I guess I would have phrased it the other way around, which is that cities typically start with private sector success and then eventually the public sector catches up. And they start performing better when the public sector catches up. The issue of public transportation in the U.S. is really interesting because it's very hard to find a part of America apart from, let's say, the four or five densest cities where rail really makes much sense. Most of urban America was built around the automobile. What was built in the 20th century was built around the car.
And that's still the fact. You have to have...
Measured by bodies, absolutely. But measured by economic wealth, maybe a little bit less so. But that doesn't mean that you eliminate the need for public transportation. Maintaining a car for every adult is a very expensive thing for lower middle-income Americans. And so public transportation in a place like Houston really is crucial. I mean, Houston is a very car-based city, but it still needs public transportation. And the beauty is we have, you know, the possibility of doing technological innovation with smart, you know, electric buses. We can have in some future date, we can have autonomous buses that are carrying around here. We can have buses of different sizes. So one of the points that transportation economists have often made is just there's not a lot that you can do with a train that you can't do with a bus on a dedicated lane in an urban area. So you've got to make a dedicated lane. But once you've got the bus, you know, you put Wi-Fi in the bus, you can put, you know, all sorts of fun things in the bus. And so just you want to think a lot about what buses can add to you know, provide mobility for poor Americans at a vastly lower cost. And we see this also in the developing world, where bus rapid transit has been one of the great public transit success stories, where it just provides massive mobility in places like Bogota with the Transmilenio at just a fraction of the cost that rail would bring.
I have been there, and I experienced the system there in Bogota. It's very
a little
nice.
Crowded. It's yeah. a little crowded now, yeah. but it is very nice. Yeah.
And you have special platforms to
yeah,
stay
absolutely.
For the bus.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's, yeah. You are an advocate of flourishing cities, but you yourself went to live in a suburb.
It's absolutely true.
How
proving,
come?
Proving that I'm an economist, not a lifestyle consultant. I often have a joke that I went to live in my suburb to study NIMBYism at close quarters.
But it's a social experiment.
But the truth of the matter is that family location decisions are joint decisions involving spouses.
So it's democracy, micro democracy.
And I got to choose the metropolitan area, and the location within the metropolitan area our home looks a lot like the home that my wife grew up in, and nothing like the 2-bedroom apartment in Manhattan that I grew up in. But that being said, you know, there are nice things about suburbs too. You know, you could live with lots of different things, and different places to live are appropriate at different points of people's lives.
Yeah, one question, maybe it's too strange a question, but here in the European Union. There's an ambition to become the first climate neutral continent by 2050. Can cities help us reaching that goal to become the first climate neutral continent?
I certainly think so. I've worked on this together with Matt Kahn, where we've estimated carbon emissions associated with living in different ways throughout the U.S. And certainly the prevailing pattern is that in terms of household emissions, which are primarily what's involved in heating and cooling your house and then transportation, places that look green or brown and places that look brown or green. That both because of much shorter distances involved in moving around cities and because typically urban apartments, even holding income and family size constant, are smaller, right? They use much less energy to heat and cool. And so for that reason, density proximity is sort of a crucial thing. It's important when you think about the importance of density to also think about other rules that then relate to climate. So for example, you never want to think just about the climate neutrality of a building on its own. So I can put a building in the middle of, you know, the Black Forest and make it, you know, carbon neutral, putting solar panels all over it. But if the owner still needs to drive 40 miles to any time they want to do anything, you've undone all of that. The other thing that's important in the US context is where you're located. And here I think California environmentalism has actually done a bad thing for the environment, because if you look across the U.S., by far the most naturally low-carbon part of the U.S. is coastal California. And that's because they have very mild winters and very mild summers. And consequently, you don't need a lot of heating and you don't need a lot of cooling, as opposed to other parts of the U.S. where, you know, the Midwest, which has horrendously hot summers and horrendously cold winters, and you need enormous amounts of energy. And so if you really were interested in minimizing America's carbon footprint, what you would do as a California environmental activist is you'd be rooting for every high-rise development that could possibly go on the San Francisco Bay, right, near to the California public transit system there. But of course, they haven't been, and they have environmental impact reviews that are sadly one-sided in the sense that they ask you, what's the impact on the local environment, right, if you build here, whereas you've also got to ask, what's the global impact on the global environment if you're pushed to build something else? Because California doesn't get to say no to the amount of development, they just get to say no to it in California. And when you turn off the tap outside of San Francisco, it turns on outside of Houston, it turns on outside of Oklahoma City, and you have the building in areas that are much less environmentally friendly than they would be in California.
So let's say the European cities, if they would take this sort of longer view, this sort of global view, could help, let's say, strengthen European policymaking towards the long-term climate strategy of the Union.
I think you always want to bring urban form into thinking about climate strategy. I think that's certainly right. Yeah.
You talked about how fascinating a special part of Shanghai is, a special part of Mumbai. Is there also a special place you very much like in Europe?
There are so many. I mean, I remain completely in love with Amsterdam, in part because, you know, I grew up in a city that's a child of Amsterdam, right? I mean, I went to a school that was founded by the Dutch, who were keenly aware of our Dutch heritage. But it's also, I mean, it's the culture, obviously. I think the new recreation of the Rijksmuseum does a wonderful job of making the case that Night Watch is actually, you know, is better than the Mona Lisa. Clearly that was the point of the thing, and clearly they're making that case. But I think also for me, when I think about the roots of the political freedom that is so central to what I think is most valuable in governments, and I think of the war that the Dutch fought for freedom against their imperial overlords, and the creation of the incredibly successful republic that followed, as being sort of a magical moment in world history, and one that very much prefigures the American Revolution 150 years afterwards. So all of those things are wrapped up in my experiences of Amsterdam, and it's certainly a place that I deeply treasure.
Professor Glaser, may I thank you for having this insightful conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, this was episode 82 of Betrouwbare Bronnen. Thank you for listening. Keep in touch, and our next episode will be in Dutch. Deze aflevering is mede mogelijk gemaakt door Wie Nederland.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Janssen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.